The following audio file was recorded on April 8th in Nashville, Tennessee by Earnhardt Productions Incorporated at a voting rights and election reform conference titled Gathering to Save Our Democracy. It has been uploaded to this site courtesy of the January 30th Coalition, an Ohio-based voting rights group which endorsed the conference. You are welcome to copy and distribute or broadcast this recording. Please also consider making a donation to Radio for All so that recordings like this one can continue to be made available.
We have met and persevered over the last couple of days, but we really view this as just one more step in a necessary process. And again, I am extremely thankful to Congresswoman McKinney and her staff for allowing, at least today, for the best route from New York to Atlanta to be through Nashville. So we do appreciate that. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney is a Democrat representing Atlanta. She's a sixth-term congresswoman. And because you folks have heard more from me than you care to, I want to just introduce her briefly by repeating something I read recently, which is very true. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney remains unafraid to speak truth to power and stand for the interest of the people. She is an independent and brilliant thinker, and she represents all of us in Congress with the respect and admiration of people of all races, walks, and faiths all over the world. Congresswoman McKinney.
Let's see how long we can keep this enthusiasm up, because you know they say 4 years is a long time. But we have to remember, we must not forget, and we must not let this issue die, or else I shudder to think what America will become. I have to recognize two friends. I don't know, I see one, Andy Silver from North Carolina, who is here. He travels all over America on this issue, but he was there with me in 2002 when we suffered our electoral defeat at the hands of the Republicans and a massive crossover vote. And Roxanne Gcott, is she here? Is Roxanne here? I noticed that she was in the materials, but she came to me after that election and said, have I got some news for you? And it was about a file that had been installed on some server, and the name of it was Rob Georgia. And some strange things happened in Georgia in 2002. So I first of all, I want to thank you for coming together and for doing this, especially in the South, because we need help with organizing and activism in the South. And most of the issues that spark America's conscience and that bring people together and move them to act are not happening in the South. So it's important that this is happening in Tennessee. Now, for those of you who don't know who I am, I just happened to ask a little question about September 11th. And that was, what did the Bush administration know and when did it know it about the tragic events of September 11th? Now, that was a most responsible question, so I thought. But for those who have something to hide, they don't want those questions asked. They certainly don't want the American people to have the answers. And so I suffered mightily for asking that question. But then, why was it important for me to come here? It was important for me to come here because, like you, I certainly feel victimized by a system that is slipping away from the grips of the American people. I have seen electioneering in its worst and most cruel effects. From 1992, when I first ran for Congress, became Georgia's first black woman elected to Congress. I was sworn in January of 1993, and shortly thereafter, a lawsuit was filed against the district alleging racial gerrymandering. Of course, the leader was the white candidate that I had defeated in the election. The district was redistricted. The case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. We lost with the vote of Clarence Thomas, who doesn't believe in the Voting Rights Act, by the way. And so they drew a new district for me and began to write my political obituary. The district was 30% black. I was supposed to lose because of people power. We didn't lose, and we continued into Congress. Well, then something else happened, and that was September 11th. And while I had given the local Georgia powers that be a reason for feeling a bit uncomfortable with me, there had been no real reason for national leadership, national operatives to pay attention to little old me. Until I asked that question. Then Republicans came out of the woodworks. Georgia is an open primary state. And so that means that Republicans can vote on election day without any kind of prior registration or anything in a Democratic primary. And so what the Republicans did was they found a black woman who was a Republican to run in the Democratic primary. And then 48,000 Republicans crossed over on election day and voted in the Republican primary. Now, I won the Democratic vote, but I lost the Republican vote. And so I lost the Democratic primary and I lost the election. So I had to sit out these last 2 years in from Congress. And after I lost the election, then that's when a group of computer programmers came to me and said, "We've got problems in Georgia, and it's with these electronic voting machines." And so then I began to try and put my life back into order and at the same time pay attention to this issue. I think I need to say something up front, and that is that the electronic voting machines didn't create election fraud. They didn't create stealing elections. And the African American community fully knows this, particularly in the South, where we have had to grapple with our right to vote being stolen every election. That's why the African American community is still angry about what happened in Florida of 2000. But what happened in Florida of 2000 didn't stop in Florida, because it went from Florida in 2000 to Georgia in 2002 to California with the election recall of Governor Gray Davis. Then Tom DeLay instituted mid-decennial redistricting and was able to capture 5 congressional districts as a result of redistricting. And so now Georgia just finished its redistricting and California is about to do another redistricting. What we are seeing is a wholesale revolution in the way elections are being conducted in this country, and it's happening before our very eyes. Now, in Florida, I watched what happened. Well, I had my own situation in Georgia in 2000. I was accused of having a campaign rally inside one of the voting precincts. Now, we didn't have a rally, but what happened was the Republicans came into one of our strong black voting precincts and told the election officials to shut down the voting process, and folks were out the door still standing in line waiting to vote. So the same kind of crass effort to stop the black vote that was exposed in Florida, I know for a fact, took place in Georgia and probably all across the South. Now, what happened after that was there was this British, American, but living in Britain, journalist, Greg Palast. And so, in reading his material, and that's what got me into trouble with September 11th, because I read my own material. So in reading his material, I saw that there was a Georgia connection to what happened in Florida. So I decided to do a town hall meeting and put the officials of Choice Point on the record, sworn, of course, and we got them to admit to some amazing things. And if you read Greg Palast's book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, or buy his CD, you can read, you probably have already read, about some of the things that Choice Point was responsible for. And it's interesting because Catherine Harris was rewarded by them drawing a congressional district just for her, and I was rewarded by them ganging up on me and kicking me out of Congress. Interesting. But that's what happened in Florida, and it also happened in Georgia, in my own election. And then comes 2004, and a lot of things happen. One of those things is that I have to decide whether or not I'm going to run again for Congress. Now, the temptation was for me to stay very comfortably ensconced in the private world where I could go out and speak to people who think like us and be very comfortable and warmly embraced. Or well, you know, I had talked so much about role models for our kids and the African-American experience and looking back on the strong leadership. My thing is COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. And so I understood the systematic decimation of black leadership by the authorities at will, including even murder, just because, interesting to say that now in Tennessee. I was just in Memphis a couple of days ago. And then to be able to know that I was right, for the people to know that I was right, for everyone to know that I had been wronged, and for me to stay down and not get back up again and show a community that it's possible to fight back and win. And so despite what my mother gave me as her best advice, which was to stay the heck out of politics, I decided to get back into it. And it's a good thing, because now I can tell you from firsthand experience as a candidate what it's like to have all of the most powerful forces arrayed possible in this country against you, and then still be able to prevail even with electronic voting machines that you know don't work. And we know that they didn't work in my campaign because they broke down. Now, there's nothing quite so hot as a Georgia summer. But guess what? The Diebold machines break down in the heat. Now, I wonder if our illustrious Secretary of State, Kathy Cox, who wants to be the next governor of Georgia, first woman governor of Georgia, ask the question, how do the machines perform in the heat? If she had just asked that simple question, we would have had an alternative to the Diebold machines. But then by that time, of course, she had already allowed Diebold to place her photograph and the seal of the state of Georgia on their promotional materials. So she had become wedded to this particular system, which I think kind of is a conflict of interest. Well, before I was so unceremoniously ushered out of Washington, there was an African-American man who was an accountant who had come to me and asked for the opportunity to place a bid to provide Georgia with its electronic voting machines. His name was Ethan Gibbs, and his company, I'm in Tennessee. True vote. So I went to the Secretary of State's office, talked to her head black man, and it's the way they do things down here. And so I said, we've got an African-American who would like to at least bid on the machines. It was only, 2 years later that I found out that he was not even afforded the opportunity to place a bid. And Georgia spent $54 million putting these electronic voting machines all over the state. His machine was the kind of machine with all of the built-in guarantees, I guess, or verifiability that I think the expert community, which I think I call you the experts at this, are asking for. He had a 1-800, well, first of all, you got your paper receipt. And your paper receipt had a randomly generated number. And then you could call the 1-800 number and punch in your randomly generated number. And you would be told which races you voted in, which elections you voted in, what number your vote was of the total number, X number of votes that had been cast. It wouldn't tell you who you voted for, but it could tell you that you voted in the Secretary of State's race, you voted in State House District 94 race. It would tell you all of those things that would give you some certainty as to, well, yeah, I did cast my vote. I cast my vote correctly. I voted in this race, the one that I wanted to. And I know that my vote was X number out of a total number of X number of votes that was cast. That, I believe, is what the activist community wanted or wants. And TrueVote had the solution. And it's interesting because I called Mr. Gibbs. He had been spending a lot of time in Georgia. And I was scheduled to speak out in California, and I wanted him to go with me and to demonstrate his machine. So I called him on the Thursday, and I asked him to come. And he said, well, you know, I've been traveling, I've been spending so much money, and I just don't think that I can go all the way out to California. I don't think I can afford it. And so I told him, well, don't say no. Let me work on something. I'll call you back on Friday morning. I called him back, left a message on his voicemail on Friday morning. Meanwhile, I get out to California, and that night, or I think it was that night, I get a phone call saying he's been in a terrible accident. He was supposed to go the following week, I believe, to Ohio to demonstrate his machine. He was supposed to testify. That's right. And so Avon Gibbs's loss is our loss, is America's loss. And I would hope that a part of this activism around this issue always recalls the memory of the man who showed to us in the activist community that it is possible to have an electronic machine that does what we want it to do. And so it is not the incapability of the machines, but rather the lack of will of those who purchase those machines and make them work. And so then finally, in my election, aside from the machines breaking down, because of the work that the computer programmers in Georgia had done, we all decided in my campaign, of course, you know, it's hard for me to raise money. I don't raise no money. Let me just break it down. And I had to take scarce campaign dollars to put a program together that allowed us to monitor not only the machines, the operation of the machines, but the interaction of the voters with the machines, the interaction of the polling officials with the machines, the interaction of the so-called Diebold repair people with the machines, and then, of course, with the election results. Scarce campaign dollars, but we did that. And we monitored these machines and the voting in about 100 of our precincts. We discovered a whole host of problems, which I'm sure you are all familiar with, freezing screens, batteries dying, votes being cast for a candidate that the voter didn't intend to vote for. The inadequacy of the training of the polling officials themselves. And so I would sort of test at my own voting precinct to ask a polling official, well, you know, what does this number mean? What does that number mean? And they don't know. They don't have a clue. They really don't know anything about these machines. And so we got our poll watchers there before the break of day, and they were told to make sure that the machines were zeroed out and all of that. There was uneven access to the machines. Some polling officials said, yes, you can do it. Other polling officials were quite hostile. Other polling officials just didn't know whether or not to allow us to have that kind of access. But at the end of the day, because we had in our campaign people like you who were willing to spend the precious hours to train all of these poll watchers about 200 people we had dedicated to this task, we were able to catch a whole lot of stuff and document a lot of things that happened in Georgia, and I'm sure that you've probably seen them on, I think it's Voters for Choice, the website. Now, if each of us as candidates have to take money away from our media budgets in order to assure the integrity of the vote itself, then you can imagine that we have a serious problem even from the standpoint of the candidate. You have a serious problem because you want your candidate to win, and you don't want the election to be rigged. But as it stands right now, we don't have a clue as to whether or not our elections will be rigged. Now, the reason I say this, and then I'll close and I'll let you ask me some questions, is because I also have had the pleasure and the honor to work with Bev Harris of Black Box Voting. I will be with her in the next few days also, where she is going to do a public demonstration of something that I was allowed to do in a private kind of setting, but I think it was a press conference, but you know, the mainstream corporate press, you know, everybody shows up but the press. Well, at any rate, so maybe Brad was there. Where is Brad? But with three clicks of a mouse, I was able to hack, and some instructions from those who know how to do this, I was able to hack into the Microsoft program that tabulates the votes, change the election vote, election vote, and then exit from the program. Now, I saw it, I did it, and so then that means that I kind of know that it can be done. When she does this next press conference, hopefully the press will be there, and everybody will know that it can be done. And then I think the curtain will have been pulled off the Wizard in Oz. Now, as I said in a cartoon that Mike Rupert drew, depicting the Wizard of Oz working all the levers, and then little Toto, the dog, pulling the curtain behind so that we see it's just a man. Just a man working the machine. And that Toto, the dog, in the cartoon was the alternative media. Now, the alternative media have pulled the covers off and have allowed us to see the inner workings of the machine. Maybe I should close with this. Mario Savio said during the free speech movement at Berkeley that there comes a time when the machine becomes so odious that you can't take part. You can't even take part. And that you have to put your entire body against the gears and the levers and the wheels, and you have to stop the machine. You have to say to those people who own the machine, who run the machine, that if you don't stop it, we will stop it. And I think that's what the previous speaker was talking about, and all of the speakers for this weekend are talking about stopping this mean, ugly, odious machine. And it can be done through litigation. It can be done through the alternative media. It can be done through legislation, if you can find folks who have the will to vote the right way. It can be done through a courageous senator from California standing up and saying, "I object." You guys know me because you know that I have put my entire body against the gears and the levers and the wheels of this machine, and I have tried to stop it. But my little actions alone aren't enough. Even on the inside, there's nothing that works like juice on the outside. And you guys are the juice. And together, all of you doing these wonderful acts to encourage justice and to encourage the right thing to happen for our country so that our country can return to its noblest values. All of you doing these things, I think, can erase and knock down, as Bobby Kennedy said, the mightiest walls of oppression. So we have no choice but to be bloodied and bruised, but to get back up again. And when we get back up, and when we fight back, we can win. Thank you. Okay, the questioner asked about the episode with Secretary Rumsfeld and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Richard Myers. Yeah, I asked a couple of questions. The first time, I always get in trouble because, you know, now I have seen through it all. And also because they kicked me out, I have nothing to lose. It ain't no big deal no more. So anyway, Rumsfeld was speechless the first time, and then the second time he couldn't remember all the questions I asked. But how can we have this breakthrough for truth? First of all, we have to support the organizations and the institutions that tell us the truth. Because otherwise, we won't know what the truth is. Our truth will be their truth, which is exactly the opposite of the truth. I've never seen anything like this time, this period, this era. So that's the first thing. We have to support them. And it does take money. I heard, was it Brad who was also talking about if you care to donate? Yeah, in the end, it's whose revolution gets funded. And we have to fund our own revolution, or else somebody else is going to fund it and then co-opt it, or else it'll be crushed. So we do have to support those organizations that give us the truth. Then the other thing we have to do is something that I used to try and teach my staff, and I hope that they learned the lesson. And that is, we have to learn how to discern. We have to learn how to see the invisible, hear the unspoken, and read the unwritten. We have to understand that when we see the news, it's just as important for us to know what's left out as it is for us to know what they have written, and how they've written it, and why they've written it. So we have to inform ourselves, and we have to support those who provide us the information.
Thank you for being here, and I risk of going off topic a little bit, I would just like to thank you for speaking at that COPA event last week, which was Coalition on Political Assassinations. And I'd just like to invite you to maybe make some comments about either that event or Martin Luther King assassination in particular.
The Committee on Political Assassinations, yes. I was here with that organization on April 4th and paid a visit to the Lorraine Motel. Now, I've done an awful lot of work on the counterintelligence program, and am fortunate enough to have presented to Mary Robinson when she was the United Nations Commissioner for Human Rights, a paper on the impact of COINTELPRO and black leadership in this country. Don't think that what you see in black America is what black America is. Black America has been decimated by regime change. Regime change is nothing new. It didn't start with Patrice Lumumba in Africa. It's happened right here, starting in 1919 with Marcus Garvey, when J. Edgar Hoover wrote in a memo that he excites the Negroes, and therefore we got to figure out a way to get rid of him. And they did. And if you go right down the list of all of them, so, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard looks the same all over America because it's meant to be that way. Anyway, I did in 2000, which is last year I was a member of the Congressional Black Caucus, a conference on the murder of Martin Luther King. And I don't say the death because he didn't die a natural death. He was murdered, and we have to remember that. We assembled Judge Joe Brown, William Pepper, the attorney, Phil Mellinson, Lyndon Barston, who has done 20 years of his, devoted 20 years of his life on research on James Earl Ray. We had Judge Joe Brown. We had Martin King III, of course, because he's from Atlanta, from Georgia. And this distinguished panel explored all of the unanswered questions about the murder of Dr. King. And of course, with the December 1999 trial, here in Tennessee, we know a lot more than we did from the government. Basically, there's so much that needs to be known and exposed about what happened to Malcolm, what happened to Martin. I intend to do the next, I invite you all to come to Washington in September to the Congressional Black Caucus weekend, where we are going to look at cultural icons like Paul Robeson, MK Ultra program, and Jimi Hendrix and Bob Marley and Tupac. And we're going to ask important questions about what happened to them and why do they have CIA and FBI files and what's in those files and what do the American people need to know. So anyway, the COPA convention was very interesting, and Larry Teeter, who is Sirhan Sirhan's attorney, was there as well, and we got a chance to learn a lot of things about RFK's assassination.
Congresswoman McKinney, I know you are being guided by divine direction, but I also know that you are under divine protection. And I'm grateful to God for that.
Thank you.
The question is, first of all, I want to tell you all, this man to my right, Larry English, and I met a few years ago because of True Vote. Larry saw us on a television show. And Larry writes for a magazine that's worldwide circulated. He's an information specialist, and tells people how to get it right. He did a story on True Vote and gave us credibility out the yang-yang. Supposed to be yin-yang, but in the hood is yang-yang. And Larry was very helpful. I just want to tell you all this. I left True Vote for a while, but Ethan Gibbs' widow came to meet Congresswoman McKinney and asked me if I'd come back and help. And I want all of you all to know that in August, True Vote will be on the market. Thank you very much.
Oh, beautiful.
Statement about True Vote. When I discovered Ethan Gibbs and caught up with him and reviewed the True Vote system, many of us I know have written off the electronic voting. But this was an example. Ethan was not a computer programmer.
Right.
He was an accountant and an auditor. And so he brought that view to developing the design of the True Vote system. And so it had the capability of the auditability.
Mm-hmm.
That is required, and verifiability. Now, the one thing that may need to be done is also that electronic, once you get access to the fact that you can verify your vote, it may also need to provide confirmation of who your vote was cast for. And that would be the thing that would complete that product. But I want to say thank you for mentioning Ethan. I considered him a friend, and
mm-hmm.
he was definitely a pioneer in this journey and in this fight. And so thank you very much for that.
Honorable Representative McKinney, I'm very pleased that you won this past election. I voted for you. I'm a constituent.
Oh, wow.
And
always good to hear from a constituent.
And some of your staffers are my personal friends.
Oh.
And I've been working on this issue of transparent elections since you appeared at the conference at the Auburn Avenue Research Library.
Oh.
And thank you so much for continuing to follow through. However, my question is about a future event happening in the near future. April 18th will be a commission being held in Washington, D.C. with James Baker III and former President Jimmy Carter to investigate our election system. Do you have any hope that this will be a fair commission? And can you just comment on this upcoming event?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm going to have to get a little more information. Somebody else actually mentioned it to me as I was sitting there in the front pew, and I was not aware of this. But now, President Carter, I love that man. James Baker, well, you know. So, I think it would be very important. I don't know what the structure of this commission is going to be, but it's very important for the activists to show up and to have input if there's possible. And, you know, there's some women who are members of Code Pink. And they are the gutsiest women that I have ever seen. They have been drug out of committee hearings. Yes, that's what I'm talking about, Code Pink. That's Medea Benjamin's organization. And, you know, a little ratcheting up in a volume that is audible to them. They don't hear us right now. But there are ways in which we can be heard and seen, and it just takes a little audacious activism. So we need to do that, be there, and all of that sort of stuff. And I will look more into Mr. Baker and President Carter's commission. I hope it's not like the 911 commission.
Thank you for all your work and for representing not only the district but the American people of conscience. Thank you.
Okay.
name is Brenda. I'm a Tennessee resident, and on behalf of Tennesseans, where I've lived most of my life, different from most white people, I'm sorry about Martin Luther King. Sincerely, it was our loss. My question, well, no, I have another thank you to the Congressional Black Caucus for showing the only backbone I have seen in Congress for standing up against the Ohio recount. My question is there any legislation that you think we could get behind and support that is presently in Congress now for election reform? And how can we bring along the black consensus?
There's going to be probably a reopening of I think there will be some hearings around HAVA. There's Rush Holt's bill. I think Senator Boxer has a bill. And so we can look at those pieces of legislation. I don't think campaign finance reform was all it was kind of cooked up to be. So we could look at campaign finance reform. I usually co-sponsored the, you know, public financing bill, which generally goes nowhere. And then I have my own Voters' Choice Act, which allows, which we haven't dropped it yet, but it will sort of do a little voter reform around single-member districts and preference voting and limited voting and that sort of stuff. But in terms of actually changing the system and making it more accountable, that won't happen unless there's a massive movement of people to sort of force that to happen. Now, we do have, we have courageous members of Congress who take tough votes. And they take tough votes. They are generally in safe districts, which allows them to do that. But they're still tough votes nonetheless, because they're like one of five or one of six or sometimes one of two. That's generally me and Ron Paul. And I'm not in a safe district. But there, we do have some good members. Then we have more members who know what the right thing to do is, but if we had a little bit more agitation, they would do the right thing. So, you know, the end, the sort of the final message is that the system still belongs to us. Now, I can't say that for 4 years from now, but right now the system still belongs to us. And so we can either get active and take this system back, or we can stay marginalized and alienated and leave it to the bad guys. And we've already begun to see what they can do. They have a whole lot of power, but in the end, they're just average, ordinary folks. They put on their pants just like we do. They ain't no special rocket scientists or brain surgeons. They might need some surgery. But they're no special people. They just happen to have been blessed with power. And we have to bless people who think like us with that same kind of power and take care of the people that we vote for. We can no longer just afford to cast the vote just because it's a D. It's got to be a good D. It's got to be the right D, or against an R, because I'm sure that if I looked hard enough, I could find one or two good Republicans if Tom DeLay will still let them have the opportunity to get elected. So as one of the previous speakers said, this really isn't Democrat or Republican or Green or Independent at this point. It's so critical. It's so crucial. This is about saving America. And I think back on the courageous young people, basically, who were the students of the day in the 1960s, who faced dogs, water hoses, racist sheriffs and police chiefs. They faced jail. They faced everything that American power in the South had to dish on them. But they faced it, and they prevailed. And because of their courage, people from all over the country ended up coming down South to prove a point and to take a stand. So we know within our lifetimes that change is possible. And we also know that average, ordinary people can make that change. So we have to do what we do now, because to do anything less would just be such a shame and so honorless to those people who sacrificed everything so we could be where we are today. Thank you very much.
Well, I have just a very few closing remarks. We want, in addition to that delicious peach cobbler at lunch, we have another treat for everyone who showed up. And if you don't have one of Kip Humphrey's buttons, "I showed up," it's something you can show your grandchildren to say, "I was at the Second American Revolution," right up in the front row in Jefferson Street Missionary Baptist Church. So once I make my closing remarks, anyone who would like to join us gently to protect the equipment up here to get a group picture with Congresswoman McKinney, we'll get some pictures for everyone who's here who took the time and effort to show up and be counted. Now, I'd like to do two things very briefly to close. I was not kidding when I said 30 days ago this idea really took off, but we had been conceiving it for maybe 2 or 3 months and had been talking about it with you on the net. Wouldn't this be a good idea? Well, we are learning that what you can conceive, you also can achieve. So I'd like to put a wishful thinking sort of idea in your head. In less than 90 days, I would like to see all of you, and maybe 10 times as many people, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in Independence Hall, on the 4th of July week, and invite all of the democracies on the planet to join us for our second conference. We'd love to find one of you states who want to take charge of that. there we go. Mary Beth, I think we might deputize you or something. We started Friday, and we started this morning in the appropriate way here in a church. We had invocations. I'd like to close with a prayer from Indian people who helped civilize me about 12 years ago, a prayer that is my daily mantra from the Hopi elders. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like us to close with this prayer. You have been telling the people that this is the 11th hour. Now you must go back and tell the people that this is the hour. Here are the things that must be considered. Where are you living? What are you doing? What are your relationships? Are you in right relation? Where is your water? Know our garden. It is time to speak your truth. Create your community. Be good to each other. And do not look outside yourself for the leader. This could be a good time. There is a river flowing now very fast. It is so great and swift that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel like they are being torn apart, and they will suffer greatly. No, the river has its destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore, push off towards the middle of the river. Keep our eyes open and our heads above the water. See who is there with you and celebrate. At this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment we do, our spiritual growth and journey comes to a halt. The time of the lonely wolf is over. Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and vocabulary. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Thank you for coming.